Rose, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So I just have to say, this is radio, that you look gorgeous. You must have been keeping yourself well.
Thank you.
Now, I want you to take me back in time to when you probably didn't look any younger than you look today. 1967, who were you and where were you as a person, as a musician? Just take us into a little time capsule.
1967, I was working in a, I was working in a music store, Sherman Clay. And I was the last one to get in the group. And that was in 68, I think it was 68. But I was working in a music store. And I thought I loved my job because I was used to singing with the family. Getting in the band wasn't, that's why it took me so long to get in the band, because I had been basically in the family band all my life. We started when we were 5 and 6 years old. And we started singing in church, and my parents used to take us around from church to church doing little concerts. And so when I got in the group, it was like, you know, it was like pulling teeth in a way of speaking, because I was just so happy with being out of a musical group. So that's what I was doing in 67. I was working in a music store.
Tell me what you mean when you say I was the last one to get in the group.
Well, after the group had formed, basically, the group was made up of the best of both bands. My brother, each of my brothers had a band, and the best of Freddie's band, the best of Sly's band. And Sly was telling me, now the last one, that Rose, the band will be complete once you get in the band. So that's what I mean when I say the last one. I wasn't the last one in a way of looking at it, because I'd always sang with my brother. So I wasn't really the last one to, you know, but in that respect, it was.
Was there kind of a rivalry between your brothers to try to get you to sign on to one of the bands, or was it a clear, you know, decision?
No, because I was, at the time, my brother had, Sly had this nightclub called Bo Peeps, and I was the singer for both the bands.
Ah.
So, you know, one night Sly's band would play, one night Freddie's band would play. And we would, they always invited a special guest, and if that guest didn't show up, I was the special guest.
So tell me this: you grew up in this musical family, all this talent. What did you grow up listening to? What did you listen to, and how did you listen to it? I mean, did you listen to Mahalia on a record? Did you listen to the radio? What did you listen to growing up?
We didn't listen to the radio a lot. The most we listened was on the Sunday mornings, and my dad would always be have the radio on, listening to quartets, the Blind Boys, just different quartets. And sometimes we'd hear Mahalia Jackson, but it was the Gospel Harmonettes, Dorothy Love Coates and the Gospel Harmonettes. That's an old group. And that's who we listened to most, and each other. We made a lot of music. So we didn't have time to really sit around and critique a lot of people. We just did our own music with pots and pans and piano and whatever we could tap on. We just made our own music. And my sister played the piano, my older sister. And that's what we grew up listening to, was each other. I think that's why our music ended up sounding the way it did, because we fed off of each other.
So when Sly said, okay, come on, you gotta join into this band, what did you think the band was? Like, if you had to describe them to someone who, like, say that you're trying to convince me to come to a show that you had back in 68. We're doing this show that's
really fun and energetic, and it's all of our own music, and you're gonna love it. That's how we looked at it. That's how we talked about it. That's how we saw it. It was good, wholesome, fun music. Any age could come. Anybody in your family could come. Any age could dance to. It was nothing bad about it. You couldn't say anything bad about the music. It was all good music. So that's the way our music was, and still is.
Tell me about like an early show that you might have done, and the crowd especially, because times keep cycling around, and at some points, and although I was but a wee tot in the late 60s.
Me too.
That's right, girl. It strikes me that people were crossing boundaries, whether they were racial, cultural, geographic. What do you remember about the audiences that you played to?
You know, the audiences were, I think they were taken, they were surprised because we were different. We were so different. And the concerts would start off, you know, just like a regular concert. But after they enjoyed, I guess, maybe half of the concert, or they had, after maybe three songs, maybe two or three songs, there was a different expression that came on their faces, and they responded differently than they did when they first came. You know, it's like they were taken by surprise, like they were really, really astounded with, this is a different set of people. And the music was different. So the audiences, they would just go into, many times they try to run up on the stage with us, and because they just got hysterically excited. Which was good. It wasn't out of order. It was good. The response was great.
I can just imagine the audiences. And was there a moment when maybe you started playing bigger venues and you realized, wow, this is something that other people have latched onto, not just a few people in a small club, but a large group of people in a generation, in a way.
I think that kind of, when we really, really got a hold of that in our heads, when it really took hold, was when we had played, sold out Madison Square Garden several times. And then we realized, I think we were backstage and we were talking, I think we're famous. You know, that wasn't our goal to be famous. We were just a bunch of kids having fun with the music. Because as you probably know, and I'm sure you're well aware of the music, it was very different.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of the music, and I want to get deeper into this, we have a blog. It's called News and Views, and you can access it through our website, and we'll talk more about that later. But we had people write in before you came in and tell us what is your favorite Sly and the Family Stone song. So you have the most votes for Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself, and I love that song. Close second was Everyday People. A woman named Nikki King wrote, Everyday People is my all-time favorite Sly and the Family Stone song. The song captures the sentiments of inclusiveness, acceptance, and equality that ought to be the goals of a fair and just society. Sly's lyrics and beat capture the energy and hopefulness of an era.
That is beautiful. That's exactly how I feel. My sentiments exactly. I love that song. I have other reasons that I like other songs, but that one in itself says the most and speaks of who we are and who everybody else is.
What's your favorite, just on a personal level?
On a personal level, and they were my favorites for different reasons. I think Hot Fun in the Summertime, and then sometimes Family Affair.
It's hard to pick, man.
It is.
It's great. But, you know, with something like Family Affair, that song runs through my life and my mind as I think about so many different things. I think about my own family. I think about growing up in Baltimore. I think about the summer, you know, because it's, you know, if you're riding around in the car with the windows down. And I'm sure a lot of people have memories of so many of the songs that you did. How do people tell you when they meet you about how you've touched them?
Pretty much the same way. They have their own experiences and why they like certain songs for certain reasons. So when they hear it, in the band now, when we play those songs, and they'll come up and say, you know, I was doing such and such a thing, and when that song came on or when that song came out, it really blessed me. It really got me over the hump, or it took me to another level. And that's why that song is my favorite song. Different people have different reasons.
Now, one of the things that strikes me a lot about music and musicians, and I have not really any musical talent, but I'm a huge fan, and just, you know, like so many people who work on News and Notes and who also listen to News and Notes, I get so deep into it. But it strikes me that it's a hard road to walk to be a musician, that you have to give up a piece of yourself in order to move forward. Was there anything that you gave up in pursuing this life, pursuing this passion?
This is what I've always done. So to say I gave up anything to do this, I couldn't say that for me. I've always done it. I thought everybody had a band when I was a little girl. I thought this is the way of the world when you're really, really tiny, you know, small. And I didn't really have to give up anything because I've always been who I am. Because I had family that traveled with us, we all traveled together. I never had to be anybody else but me. Because I had brothers on, you know, and my dad used to travel with us. So I never had to not be who I am at any time. As a matter of fact, I've always been encouraged to always be who you are and then let everything else bounce around that.
I'm thinking more of the stresses of performance, whether it is anxiety, whether it's fatigue, whether it's being tired of being on the road, whether it's temptation in the form of drugs, alcohol, shady people. How did you deal with situations where you felt things just weren't right?
Well, you know, there's a line in Hot Fun in the Summertime, and says, "I cloud nine when I want to."
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I was given that line, because that's how I would deal with whatever I didn't care to deal with at the time when we were on the road. I knew how to just tune people out. I just knew where to go in my head for that not to get the best of me. And like I said before, because I had my dad with me and my two brothers, I was sandwiched in so that, you know, I couldn't go to the right or to the left even when I wanted to, because they were there basically as my protection. You know, I couldn't do too many things that other people could get away with. I couldn't, because they were always there. It was like I was at home on the road. So I think my story is a little different probably than a lot of people's, because of the protection that they were for me.
Let me ask you about Sly. He has not been public very much in the past decade and a half. And he performed at the Grammy Awards. He has not seemed to have weathered the years as well as you have. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, he was in a position to take the brunt of whatever came at all of us. So I'm sure his response to a lot of life, the way just life takes you ups and downs, I'm sure it's taken a toll on him more so than maybe it did on me. But he's out now. He's performing now. So
are you guys tight?
Yes.
Well, you know what? We have Larry with us.
Larry, are you there? How long have you been there?
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Oh, just wonderful.
Are you on musician time, Larry?
No, we're on get lost time.
I'm not going to bust you out. But Larry, I saw you
here's the good part. I wasn't driving, so hey.
We had
a driver.
That's it. That's it.
I feel you. Larry, I just have to tell you, I saw you perform, and I don't know what year this is, but Prince had played at, I think, the Essence Awards. And at Irving Plaza, there was a show with you, Prince, Dougie Fresh, and Charles Benson. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was probably the best live show I have ever been to.
Oh, thank you.
It was just so hot. I mean, everybody brought their flavor, and it was so hot.
It was a fun night. We had a ball. Everybody was just jamming and having fun. And the crowd was pumping us up, too.
Oh, definitely. I was there.
Yeah, it was an exchange going on.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your passion. You know, how did you get into not just being a musician, like it's something that you put on as an identity, but being music?
Well, I've always been in music. My grandmother helped raise me. And I started off in tap dancing when I was about five or something like that. And then I started taking piano lessons. And then my grandmother, she was providing me with piano lessons. And then in school, I played clarinet because I wanted to play sax. So eventually I got two sax. And then I played drums in the marching band and the school orchestra. And but my main love became guitar, because when I was 11, my father decided he was going to stop playing guitar and gave me his guitar. And so I taught myself how to play the guitar. And so that was my love. And then when I was about 15, my mother, who had been traveling all over the world and had recently moved from Hawaii, she decided we would have a little trio together, the Dale Graham Trio. And we started playing together, me and my drummer and my mother, all over the Bay Area. And we were playing at this club where they had an organ and with the bass pedals on it. So I would play the guitar and the bass pedals and sing at the same time with my mother playing and singing. And so we sounded pretty fat, especially with the bass going on the foot pedals. And so we got used to having this bottom. But then we get used to that, and then the organ breaks down. And so now all of a sudden we are back with no bottom, and guitar and piano being in the same range. And so we put the organ in the shop and in hopes that it could be fixed. And I went down to San Leandro to this music store there and rented me a St. George bass. Music Unlimited was the name of the store. And I rented this bass, but I'm thinking now, this is temporary, so I'm not buying it. I'm just renting it because I'm going to bring this bad boy back soon as this organ get fixed and get back to my guitar. Well, as it turned out, the organ couldn't be repaired. And so I kind of got stuck on the bass. And so my mother decided that she all of a sudden wanted to go duo, just piano and bass. So now we didn't have a drummer. So now, to make up for not having a bass drum, I would thump the strings with my thumb and pluck the strings with my finger, and to make up for not having that backbeat. And so that's how the style was developed. And even though some people thought that was kind of a strange way to be playing the bass, it didn't bother me because it was temporary, I thought.
Well, Larry, and, let me jump in here. Aren't you glad that you didn't get stuck carrying an organ around on your back?
Just for the foot pedals part. So it turned out great. I'm happy. Yeah, that'd be kind of heavy. We packed around a B3 for a while, and so I know how that is. So, but yeah, it turned out that way. And over a period of time, that I realized that I'm stuck on the bass, and so I just got comfortable with it and kept doing it. And so eventually, when Sly was invited down to the club by this lady that we didn't know, is somebody that later on I found out that did that and heard me doing this thumping and plucking and singing and stuff, and he talked to me about what he was doing and joining this band he was starting up. And so I talked to moms about it, because we had been working together for a while now, and she's like, "Well, baby, I've been all over the world doing my thing, and so this might be an opportunity for you. So you go head on." And it was rough, I have to admit, because I kind of like
cook for you anymore. She said, "No more Sunday dinner. You dropped out of our thing. You're moving on to Sly's thing."
At that time, Grandmama doing the cooking for all of us anyway. So,
well, one of the things I'm struck by is how this really was a family affair, not just for, you know, the Family Stone, but I mean, obviously you were a part of the Family Stone band, but your family is one. It's like deep roots.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
How was it different being on the road with Sly and the Family Stone than it was touring when you were younger?
Well, we weren't really touring before Sly and the Family Stone. My mother had been around the world, you know, playing music and with her band. But everything that I had done, to that point was local. So I had really never been on tour, if you want to call it the Bay Area, going from San Jose to Oakland to San Francisco and stuff like that. That's kind of like a little tour, but not really.
Well, Larry, do you remember the first time or one of the first times that you went out on the road, and how was that different for you?
Well, I mean, it was different because, you know, you by that time, you know, Sly and the Family Stone, all of us were, like, you know, we were like family. So there's comfort in that. But, you know, your family that you were raised with and that raised you, you know, you're leaving them, you know, you don't have them around. You don't have that security there. You know, you don't have grandma, you know, we call it mommy M. We don't have mommy M's cooking, you know, and you're staying in places that you've never stayed. And, you know, so it's different in that way. But on the positive, it's so exciting because you're experiencing things that you have never experienced or have never seen before. So it was great in that way, meeting people that you would never meet and experiencing other cultures that you would never experience otherwise. So,
well, Rose,
those
was
were
just
positive things.
Rose was just talking about playing the garden. What do you remember about that?
Playing the garden was like incredible. You know, the people, the feedback. Well, you know how New York is anyway, and the feedback from the people that was just tremendous. And you know, we, you know, were playing at some of our best. After Woodstock, we had been kicked to another level musically. You know, because of the experience there, we had tapped into a zone musically that we had never been before because of the interchange that took place at Woodstock between the audience and us. So by, you know, Madison Square Garden, and well, I say gigs after Woodstock, I mean, we were playing some of the best that we had ever played. And so that was just an incredible, incredible gig.
Let me ask both of you about Woodstock. Rose first. It struck me in just thinking about this time that there was this feeling of hope that people could work some things out. Let's pick up. So there was this hope that people could work some things out that they hadn't before, race and a lot of other issues. Did you feel like at the moment that you played Woodstock that it was more than a moment, that it was, you know, the kind of unity where you had everybody, you know, you and Carlos Santana and all these bands of different stripes and colors performing on that stage? Did you feel like something magical was happening, Rose?
Well, we knew something magical was happening, I think, after we realized that it was a sea of people in front of us. It was about 5 a.m. when we went on, and it was dark, and we were playing at our best, and the sun started to come up, and all of a sudden all we could see was just a sea of people. But the atmosphere there was, I don't know, there were a lot of stories that were written about it after the fact, but I think it was like an apex of our group. I don't know that it solved anything racially, or I don't know about that.
Well, Larry, did you have a feeling of hope? And also, I guess, when I would ask you that about not just Woodstock, but that moment in time, did you feel later cheated? Did you feel cheated by the assassinations? Did you feel cheated by some of the problems that the country moved into after those moments?
Well, I think everyone, you know, was affected by any major losses that took place during that time. But I think that's one of the contributing factors of why a music event like Woodstock would be so effective and have such a big impact, you know, at a time when so many negative things are going on in the world, and here you can go to a place of escape and experience something that for at least for a while take away some of the pain and the thoughts of what's going on the outside world. Everything else became the outside world. We were in our own world for a little while. And so as far as the people in the audience, you got all these people packed out there together, people who don't know each other, never been around each other, and the situations where you got to share. You gotta get along. I mean, you're learning to get along with thousands and thousands of people around you that you've never even been around before. So, I mean, under those circumstances and to be in that situation by surprise and to not have a bunch of shootings and stabbings and stuff like that going on, it was more like people, at least on a small scale, learning to live together under the most difficult circumstances you could be under. But what's helping the whole thing draw together is the music, because now they're seeing how the musicians are coming together too. There wasn't the competition between, well, my band is going to kick your band and this band is going, we're going to compete against that, and that spirit of competition. No, there was a spirit of camaraderie. It's like all the bands were like one, although we were divided into different sets of music that we would play, but we were all brought together too, different kinds of music, racially mixed, and so forth. So the audience is feeling that. We're feeling that from the audience. So there, again, here we've created a world that was relatively peaceful compared to what was going on the outside world. So we, as a whole, became kind of an example that 500,000 people could be thrown together by surprise and yet exist together with the common bond being music. You know, music became like the universal channel, like it is now. You can go anywhere in the world, and even though the people don't understand your language, you start playing that music, and they all of a sudden, we're all on the same page. That happened on a major scale at Woodstock. No matter where you were from, where what your background was, what your nationality was, and none of that mattered. We all became like one unit. Now, you tried doing that today, and it has been done. They tried to redo it. It didn't turn out the same way.
No, the second Woodstock definitely wasn't anything like the first. But Larry, let me ask you this. As your group moved into the 70s, you seemed to become more inward focused, more pensive, in your sound. Do you remember making a conscious shift, or was this something that just happened as you looked at the world around you, but you also dealt with your own issues?
This is for me?
Yeah.
So which part of the 70s? Which particular year?
I don't know. Lead me through it. I think over, you know, things change over time, but tell me how you felt maybe at different periods.
Well, the reason I asked is because I was only there for the first part of the 70s, like after, you know, after Riot was the last album I was on. So if you're going beyond 71, I'd say, then that would be a question for Rose.
Well, that's a good point. Rose, what do you think?
Would you ask that question again?
Well, just the last two albums in particular, how did your sound changed, and you seem to get more introspective in the records? Do you remember that shift? Do you remember why it happened?
Well, people changed. That's basically the whole thing. We all had changed by then, and we were just a product of life, of the way life had taken its toll on all of us, actually. And that's what you hear, the we were just a product of the change, the times. And that's why the sound was the way it was.
I just want to read you guys one more thing. Larry, I'm going to give you a shot at responding to this one. I was talking earlier to Rose, and we have a blog, and we ask people what their favorite songs were. And usually we get people who don't work at NPR, but one of our colleagues on a show, Day to Day, felt like writing in Karen Grigsby Bates. She is amazing. And she wrote that her favorite song was Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself. She said it was the song that got everybody out on the floor. It was always party time when that was played. But when things calmed down and they played slow drags, you always hoped the really cute brother was the one who held out his hand in invitation when Hot Fun was on the turntable. Looking forward to blasting both from my car CD player when the box set is released. What do you say, Larry?
Oh, first of all, thank you to her. I mean, that's wonderful, and a lot of people felt like that and still do when that song is played, whether it's played by us or someone else. It's a great song. I think Sly wrote a great song. I think the band did a great job on it, and it has it stood up till today. So I agree. And Hot Fun in the Summertime, of course, is, that was very appropriate at the time. And still now, people look forward to having some hot fun in the summertime. And so it creates the spirit of the time of season, because, I'm in Minneapolis now, and, there is, great rejoicing when summer comes and winter goes away. So everybody that lives other than California, I'd say on heading east, can have a really deep appreciation for when summertime comes.
Yeah, well,
if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you're with His Royal Badness, Prince, now. And I, of course, saw you on a recent tour in addition to the time that you played years ago. And Prince was so influenced by Sly. I asked Rose about Sly and how he's doing. Do you guys stay in touch? How do you think he's doing?
Is this for me?
That's for you.
No, we haven't really talked a lot over the years. So there's a lot that Rose would know that, I wouldn't really have any knowledge of. Well, but I hope he's doing great. It's a lot that I don't know.
Well, there's no way around it. You guys have created some amazing songs, and I look forward to blasting them too as I'm driving around this summer. I just hope that...
I've been doing that. I've been wearing my little box set out.
Exactly.
It's in my car right now, in my CD changer. Oh, and I have to say that the guys that put in my sound system, they did an excellent job. And I have to be careful, when I'm, at a stoplight or something, and sometimes I forget. And I look over and somebody is just like all up in my face, all in my business, right? And because my car is just bumping, the windows are shaking and the mirrors. Thank you. Yeah, bumping on some thank you. And I'm just in my own concert, right?
Absolutely.
So, hey, I'm enjoying it too. But, can I back up quickly to one thing you had mentioned back during the 70s?
Absolutely.
And a shift. If you were interested in the shift in the sound, I have a comment on that.
I'd love it.
Okay. Like on Riot going on, one shift that you would hear musically is that a lot of the songs that we did earlier, the band would play all together. And and even if there were some overdubs on some things, basically you have everybody playing together, where Riot took a new turn, and that a lot of the instruments, because Sly is able to play so well, so many instruments, he did a lot of the recording himself because the studio was there in the house. And then he would create these songs, and he would do all of the music. And then on some of the songs, certain members of the band would be brought in to overdub. That was something that was a little different than what we had been doing before, but different doesn't mean that it's, better or worse. It's just a different way of doing it. And as a matter of fact, I think because he was so successful in doing it, whether a particular song you like or don't like, the sound is going to be different because the approach is different. But at the same time, if you really look at it, he was displaying a stroke of genius here, and the fact that he could do that. I don't know if you play music or not, but to be able to play each instrument with yourself, you know, in other words, to become another person, to go from becoming the drummer to the guitar player, to the bass player, to the keyboard player, singing different parts and stuff with yourself as if you were somebody else. People weren't doing that. So since then, other people have been influenced to do that.
A lot.
A lot. I did it on a lot of my records where I played all of the instruments. You know, Sly showed a lot of people that you can do that effectively. Prince has played a lot of stuff where he plays all the instruments. Stevie Wonder, yeah, and other people, you know, so Sly actually set a standard of, if you're going to do that, this is how effective it should be in you doing so. You know, because you could, just because you can play several instruments doesn't mean that you can do it well together with yourself.
Yeah, it takes a tremendous amount of talent.
It takes a tremendous amount of talent and confidence.
Yeah. Well, I just want to reiterate that this was something that just even talking about you guys coming on the show got so much excitement going. And the box set is out now. Rose Stone, Larry Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you for letting us be
ourselves again.
Again.
Right on. Thank you.